Films now, three up for review this week. Woody Allen's latest, Magic in the Moonlight. Liam Neeson as an ex-cop on a mission in A Walk Among the Tombstones. And Wealthy and Privileged Oxonians in The Riot Club. Ruth Barton, Chris Wasser have been to see them for us, and they're with me now in studio. We'll start with Woody Allen, Magic in the Moonlight, starring Colin Firth and Emma Stone. Where are we and what's the basic setup, Ruth?
We are back in the 1920s, and Colin Firth plays an illusionist called Wailing Sue, but his real name is Stanley something, which isn't, we never quite know. It starts off with him performing his illusions, but very swiftly he gets invited to go to the French Riviera, where the smart set have found in their midst a young woman who is able to communicate with the spirits. She's a spiritualist, but his mate reckons that he can expose her for the sham she very much must be.
That's given the fact that he dresses up as a Chinese person in his trickster act, and he loves to expose others who are dressing up or pretending to be things.
Yeah.
I presume it's all about the relationship that builds between the Emma Stone character and the Colin Firth character.
It is, yeah. He's very much a Houdini type character in that he loves nothing better than to debunk, you know, fakes like Emma Stone's character, Sophie Baker. So when he goes to the house, the first thing she greets him with is, you know, what line of business are you in? I can see something in China. And he thinks, okay, this girl is onto something here. And the more time he spends with her, then he's thinking, you know, he can't find a hole in her practice. He watches her, you know, perform these seances with the family, and he's thinking, okay, this girl must be the real deal. She actually convinces him at one point. He gives a press conference and everything to say, she is the real deal. I have been wrong all these years. But a relationship forms between the two of them, and you know, they are otherwise engaged, so to speak. You know, they have love lives of their own, but she falls for him. And I think he's a little bit oblivious to the fact that she's falling for him, because when she, you know, says, I love you, more or less, he's thinking, okay, I didn't expect this to happen here. So you're not, it kind of strays away from the story about, you know, magic and whether somebody can contact the dead to, you know, are Emma Stone and Colin Firth going to end up together?
Well, here's a point in the relationship, I guess, where we're still asking the question, are they or are they not going to end up together?
I see a white house in Belgravia. 14. No, 16. Wilton Crescent. A piano.
Yes, that's all correct and rather amazing. But I don't buy it. Because I'm a rational man who believes in a rational world. Any other way lies madness.
You'd be happier if I was a fraud, because then your whole fixed worldview wouldn't be shaken up.
No, it's quite the opposite. If you knew how much I don't want you to be a fake.
Oh, but think how embarrassing it would be for you. Your whole life, you spent publicly crusading against spiritualism, and then you'd have to come out with it and say that you were wrong.
But I'm not wrong.
Colin Firth as a rational man in a rational world. He's never played that character before. And Emma Stone, both of them there in the new Woody Allen film, Magic in the Moonlight. The new Woody Allen film, it's a yearly event, the Woody Allen film, and we wait with bated breath to see whether it's going to be, yes, another Blue Jasmine, or no, another one of the several other ones that we don't like to talk about. Which is it, Ruth?
Sadly, it's the latter category. I was really hoping, because he's had something of a late career revival. I would, you know, kind of go back to Vicky Cristina Barcelona, move up through Midnight in Paris, which, you know, was okay, and Blue Jasmine, which I very, very much liked. So I was really hoping for the return to form to continue, but he's really regressed, I found, with this movie. It's very, very slight. I really, really didn't believe in the relationship, you know, between Colin Firth, who's just, you know, let's be ageist about this. He's very, very much older than Emma Stone, but the film never acknowledges this, and so I never got any chemistry between those two in terms of the performances. And partly, you know, you played that clip, which is very wordy. And there are quite a lot of sequences which are quite wordy like that.
Is that the problem?
I think that is one of the problems, yeah. I think that the script, which of course he's written himself, you know, it doesn't sparkle.
Yeah, well, it's often Woody Allen films are quite wordy, but they do sparkle because of the wit. When he goes back to these period movies, does he lose some of that, you know, New York contemporary wit? Does it just disappear?
Absolutely. And if he had cast maybe Emma Stone in a modern picture, it might have worked better, because I think Emma Stone plays a little too modern in this film. The relationship between herself and Colin Firth, look, I could not get past the fact that there's 29 years between them. And furthermore, I could not get past the fact that nobody seems to have a problem with this in the film. And they don't really look like a couple. There is something there. It's a little awkward at times, but they look like a father and daughter on occasion in the film. But I think the dialogue, it gets quite lazy in the second half. The first half looks lovely. It's a charming period piece. The music and everything just fits. Everything gels well. But in the second half, it's like, okay, like I said, you're no longer interested in where the story about, you know, is she a fake? Is she real? Where's that going? You're just thinking, it's not even that. It's, you know, why is nobody saying anything about their ages?
Because doesn't even come up. All right. What about the cast that's around them? Because there's quite a cast there.
Another aspect of a Woody Allen film, he seems to be able to get whoever he wants to act.
Who stood out for you in that surrounding cast?
Well, I suppose, you know, Marcia Gay Harden is in it.
She plays the Colin Firth's mother, is it?
Yes, yeah. She does. Yeah, I thought she was really excellent. I think she's probably the kind of outstanding, secondary, if there is a secondary character in it. I thought she was great. And they kind of fall into those Noel Coward type sort of performances very well. And partly because it's mapped out for them. There's nothing original there. So they kind of know what they should be doing and they do it very well. And I could just like to kind of add in, I think Darius Conjee's for cinematography. He's a great cinematographer.
So he gets that sense of period perfectly. We're in the 20s, the 1920s.
Yeah, and he's filmed it on film, not digital. Yeah, right. Really, well, makes
that,
a difference.
That tells its own story. Stars out of 5 from you, Chris?
I think it looks lovely, but if he'd worked on the script a little longer, it could have been much better, so maybe 2.5.
Is it wait for it to come out on DVD?
Wait for it to come out on DVD. Had he just spent another 6 months working on those jokes, they could have been a lot sharper. It's Woody Allen after all, so yeah, 2.5.
Stars from you, Ruth?
I'd echo 2.5 too. I couldn't push it any higher.
And even the cinematography, you'd still say wait for the DVD.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame, but it's just not, I wouldn't go to the cinema for it now.
All right, first film we've been speaking about this evening then, Magic in the Moonlight. Let's move on to film number 2, A Walk Among the Tombstones. Liam Neeson plays an ex-cop on a mission. An adaptation of, is it a series of books or just one of the books by Lawrence Block?
It's one of the books in a series by Lawrence Block. His most famous creation being Matthew Scudder, a private investigator who used to be a cop. And we've seen this character on the big screen before, back in 1986 with 8 Million Ways to Die, which is another adaptation of a single book in the series. Did nothing for Jeff Bridges' career. It's a terrible film. It was a box office flop as well. But this is a lot better, and it comes at a time as well when Liam Neeson is the go-to guy for these big action films. And you know, if you watch the trailer, you're thinking, okay, this is Taken 3, this is Taken 4.
Give us the setup, because it sounds a bit like Taken.
It does sound a little like Taken, but it uses its head a little more. What we have is a former cop. We get a flashback in the first 5 minutes of this alcoholic police detective in New York who one morning, while he's chasing some bad guys who've just robbed a bar, he shoots a child in the head, and it just ends his career right there.
It's accidental, it's a ricochet.
It's accidental, it's a ricochet, but you know, his life just takes a turn right there. So flash forward to 1999, and there's plenty of Y2K references shoehorned in there. He's a recovering alcoholic, attending AA meetings at night, eating alone in diners, working as a private investigator despite the fact that he has no license, and he is called upon by this shady but very rich drug dealer whose wife has been kidnapped, murdered, and returned to him in a trunk. And so he has to find the culprits.
And the shady drug dealer is none other than Cousin Matthew from Downton Abbey, Dan Stevens. And wait till you hear just how shady Cousin Matthew has become in the 20th century, or the latter part of the 20th century.
But you used to be a cop, right?
Yeah, I was with the 6th Precinct in the village for a while. And before that, I was over here with the 75th.
So why'd you quit?
I didn't like the hours, Mr. Christo.
The corruption get to you, huh?
Not really. It would have been hard to support my family without it. So, what can I do for you?
Well, this was really my brother's idea, you know, bringing you out of here.
You want? I can leave.
Someone's kidnapped my wife.
That's a federal matter.
They said not to call the cops.
Naturally they would. When did this happen?
Yesterday.
You should be talking to the FBI.
I'm talking to you.
Look, Mr. Christo.
Kenny.
Kenny, if you're asking me to run a bag, deliver money, that is not something I do.
I already paid them. Last night.
How much?
$400,000.
And your wife? Where is she?
She's dead. I paid them, but they killed her anyway.
I'm sorry.
I don't want you to be sorry. I want you to find the men who did this and bring them to me.
Dan Stevens, who formerly played Matthew Crawley in Downton Abbey there as this heroin trafficker, with Liam Neeson playing the part of the ex-cop in A Walk Among the Tombstones. Dan Stevens, at least he does a fairly decent American accent. Is it a believable character for you, Ruth?
Oh, no. I mean, this film for me, nothing about it worked. So he was part of the not workingness of this film. I sat there and I actually this very particular scene, I sat there. By this stage, I'd already drifted off the plot of the movie because I could tell what was going to happen next. And I spent the time working out who did better American accents, himself or Liam Neeson. And he wins because Liam Neeson doesn't. I don't know what Liam Neeson's accent is. As we were just saying, it's the same in every movie, but it's somewhere mid-Atlantic.
But can he manage that? You know, is he believable as the guy who's going to go out and save the world or save his family or save somebody else's family?
Yes, because if you've seen Taken 1 or Taken 2 or Taken 3, which we might as well say non-stop was Taken 3, we know this is what he does. You know, but other than that, this film didn't gel for me in any way.
I think you were more enamoured of Cousin Matthew. It's unfair to call him Cousin Matthew. Dan Stevens.
Yeah, I think he's gone very. He's gone out of his way to distance himself from that part, even in the guest, which was released last week or a couple of weeks ago. He's quite good in this. I couldn't see Cousin Matthew at all. I think, you know, he's onto something new here. But Liam Neeson, I could take very seriously as the action star, more so because he's not so much kicking ass in this film. I mean, he gets his ass kicked quite a bit in this film. But the director, Scott Frank, it uses his head. You know, at times it's a run-of-the-mill, hard-boiled detective drama, but it's quite clever at times too, and it pokes fun at maybe the fact that Liam Neeson has been playing this big action movie star over the past few years. And there's another famous phone call in the film, except this time he's not threatening to find someone kill them. He actually references Bert and Ernie in this phone call, but he manages to make Sesame Street sound very threatening, so it's quite cool.
What was the spontaneous cheering at the press screening?
It was a spontaneous cheering at the press screening. There's a scene, a knock-knock scene, as I like to call it, when Liam Neeson punches his fist through a door and injures an FBI agent on the other side. And I think I actually heard someone saying, "Go on, Limo."
All right. What is the relationship that the Liam Neeson character develops with the young homeless black youngster, which sounds terribly patronising on millions of levels?
It is. He becomes his surrogate child. So he goes into the library. He's finding it a little bit hard to work his computer because, again, it's all this Y2K stuff. And this kid, who is the idiot savant of the film, helps him and tells him how to use a computer, and then he takes him under his wing and trains him how to be a detective.
You were making comparisons here to Scandinavian dramas. I presume you weren't comparing favourably.
No, my Saturday evenings are now dedicated to whatever delight BBC Four throws up in terms of long-form thrillers, and they're brilliant. And I think that I think cinema is now really, really struggling against this competition coming from True Detective, any of these series. Yeah. I think film is finding it very, very hard to compete.
So I'm afraid what it's going to get in terms of stars then for you for A Walk Among the Tombstones, Ruth?
Well, out of patriotism and a deference to Liam Neeson, I'm going to give it a generous 2.
All right. And that's mostly for him, I'm guessing.
It
then.
Is, yeah.
And yourself, what do you think, Chris?
It can be a little uncomfortable to watch at times because it is quite violent, but I thought it was grand. Maybe 3 stars.
All right. That's A Walk Among the Tombstones, second film up for discussion this evening. Third and final is The Riot Club. This was a play originally by, what was her name?
Laura Wade.
Thank you very much, Laura Wade. Tell us about the play and the sort of wealthy, privileged group at the heart of the story.
Yeah, the play was called Posh, and I think the film could have been called Posh as well. The play came out in 2010, just as you're getting the new British government coming in, and it in turn is based, the Riot Club of the film's title is based on the Bullingdon Club, and its members very infamously included David Cameron and Boris Johnson, and they were a group of very privileged public school boys who behaved badly at Oxford.
And so parallels are being drawn between the Riot Club, but the Riot Club is a purely fictional thing, is it?
It is a purely fictional thing, but when the play came out, everybody knew what the reference was to, and in the UK now, the British press have gone very big again on this film, and they're reminding us that it's going back to Posh, which is going back to the Bullingdon Club. So, you know, nobody's in any doubt as to what the points of reference are.
Right, so we've a lot of posh boys, and into this mix comes a northern girl.
Yes, a northern girl who is the ordinary girlfriend of one of the lads, Miles, because we get a lot of history about the club and why it was established 200 years ago. It was all in honour of this effing legend, the original Riot, or YOT. And this club is going strong in 2012, whatever year it's set, but needs 2 members to make up a perfect 10. So Miles comes in, who, you know, he's the good lad in the mix, and you know he knows in his heart that he's fallen in with the wrong crowd. And then you have this sinister schoolboy, Alistair. So Miles has a girlfriend, Alistair doesn't, he can barely even talk to girls properly, and she becomes involved. I mean, a lot of this film takes place in the one room. It's at a sort of an initiation or celebration dinner to honour the two new members.
They're in some sort of country club.
In a rural pub, yeah, they've hired a function room out, and little does the owner know how much of a mess they're going to make by the end of the night, because the play was all set in the one night. So we are in this room for a while with them. It does get claustrophobic. At times it's well shot, but at the end it's a bit relentless, and the girlfriend is pulled into this, and things turn very, very sour. hour.
All right. This is a scene between the Miles character, who's the good nicest of them, you're saying,
yeah.
played by Max Irons, and he's drawn to this character, Lauren, played by Holiday Granger. And at this point, they're actually outside of the room. I think they're on the roof of a college building discussing their various upbringings, or their two upbringings.
Miles, are you posh?
Just normal.
You've got quite a posh name.
Miles Davis. My parents were listening to Kind of Blue when I was conceived.
Good job my parents didn't do that. They'd have named me Gary Barlow. So where did you go to school?
Westminster.
Oh, so not posh at all then?
I've got a bottle of tequila back in my room if you wanted to come back after.
Let's not spend 3 years avoiding the person we shagged in Freshers Week.
Listening to that that clip featuring Max Irons and Holiday Granger as the posh boy and the northern girl, the worry I would have is that this is a very, it's not at all nuanced in terms of, you know, the subtleties of the posh boy and the subtleties of the northern girl. Are we just getting stereotypes here?
Yeah, very much. And you have to know that Lauren has been added in. She wasn't in the play. She's been added into the film. So I presume to kind of bring some notion of gender balance in, but terribly cliched. I mean, you heard in that she's earthy. She stands for positive values, whereas he's, you know, got a screwed up childhood, had a screwed up childhood because he's too rich. You know, one's heart breaks for him.
Oh dear. The director here, is it Lorne Sheffring?
Lorne Sheffring, yeah.
Lorne Sheffring. What do we know Lorne Sheffring from?
An Education, critically acclaimed film, and then One Day, which is a complete mess of the book. Look, she does a very good job here in the scenes where we're just in that one room with the lads and they're having their dinner and they're drinking too much, but it just piles it on a little too heavy though in the second half of the film. And because it's based on a play, you're thinking, okay, if you went to see this play and it had a bit of an ambiguous finale and you're not too sure what the message is or what happens to the characters afterwards, fair enough, but this is a movie now and it tries to kind of leave you wondering at the end, but the problem there is that it doesn't really know what to do with itself. So once it, like, I won't say what happens in that room, but there is a major incident in this play and a lot of people would know it from actually seeing the play or reading about it, but once you come out of that room and there's a police station and meetings in the college afterwards, I just got a sense that nobody knows how to end this film.
Whereas I guess if you're in a play, you're in the claustrophobic room all the time, so you can resolve or not resolve within that claustrophobic situation. Is the problem play to screen?
I think there's a very big problem with that, and I think there's a very big problem in terms of the structure of it, because there's so much build up to this act of violence that then the kind of run down from that is very, very abrupt, and so you don't get to contemplate just has justice been done or not, or is it going to be done or not, which is really the question that the film should be asking us.
Sounds as if you didn't have a good week at the films at the cinema at all this week. What are you saying in terms of stars for our third and final film then, Ruth, The Riot Club?
I could only bring myself to give it 2 stars. I think that it has really failed in what it set out to do.
Did either of you see the play, by the way? No?
No, I didn't.
No, but that no. sounds as if
it... I think Posh actually is a better title. I don't know why they didn't keep that title.
What are you saying in stars then for The Riot Club? Although I did see on some website The Riot Club brackets Posh, so maybe they're thinking about renaming it.
You might have seen the posters as well, yeah. Which just looks like a poster for Abercrombie and Fitch, but there's just too much debauchery. It's a little gratuitous, and the characters are so hideously unlikable, so 2 out of 5.
Yeah, maybe, of course, if it goes... Would it work better in the United States? Will it work in that market better than what we might expect here in Europe from an English story, essentially?
Yeah, there is that kind of funny thing that those British costume dramas have, which is that the bad guys can end up being quite attractive. And I think that, you know, that it might translate in that way to the American market, not because I think Americans are gullible, but because the intention
is different
and the associations aren't there between that upper class, you know, Britishness.
All right, Ruth Barton and Chris Wasser talking to us about Woody Allen's latest film, Magic in the Moonlight, Liam Neeson in A Walk Among the Tombstones, and The Riot Club, brackets Posh, if you want to call it that, all of which are on general release.